Welcome to the spring term of the Vancouver Institute for Social Research. Just to get some housekeeping out of the way, the bathroom's in the back, and if you need to use it anytime, just get up and use it. You don't need to raise your hand or anything. There's also water back there. You can help yourselves to that. As always, there'll be a zero tolerance policy for homophobic, racist, or sexist behavior. Outside of that, though, you have free rein to talk about whatever you like. As many of you know, our theme this term is fantasy, ideology, media. Three overlapping and intersecting terms. And for the next few sessions, there's going to be a very powerful media philosophy inflection. This week, as many of you know, Alessandra Santos will be talking about dust and mediality and materiality. Next week, Zoe Druick from SFU's communications department is going to be discussing the video art of Natalie Bookchin. The week after that, Ilinka Irascu from UBC's German department is going to be discussing the Lacanian understanding of the uncanny. And a really rich roster all the way to the end of May. Alessandra Santos from Latin America Studies at UBC has been a supporter and mentor of this project from pretty much the get-go. And when we start to formulate this theme, fantasy, ideology, media, she was one of the first people that Am and I thought to approach because we thought it would be right up her alley. And as it happens, it is, fortuitously. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Alessandra Santos.
Hi, everybody. I would like to thank Dan and Am for the kind invitation. I'm a Visor fan, and it is a pleasure to be here tonight. Thank you all for coming. So I'd like to give special thanks to Jeff Winthrop Young, who first introduced me to UC Perica's work. I also want to thank Ernest Matisse from UBC, who gave me the opportunity to talk about this topic in his media industries course. So I'd like to tell you, to start with the disclaimer, that this is an exploratory and conceptual talk. I recently started studying contemporary media theories, and this presentation is sort of a personal map or guide to learn how to examine dust through this lens. And my goal is to continue research and write a piece on dust and entropy eventually. So my talk is Dust, Media, and Invisible Materiality. And the operating exploratory questions here are, how is dust media? What are the invisible principles and processes of technological media capitalism? How are they inscribed in the body? What does media archaeology as a method have to offer in a study of said invisible processes? How is the, and here I quote Perica, seemingly immaterial embedded in wide materials networks? How technoculture is anchored in a transformation of materials? The subsequent set of secondary but equally important questions, operating questions, are what does the relationship of media and labor indicate about social, historical, political, and affective networks? How can we have a sustainable tech industry? What environmental solutions may we envision given the conditions of tech production? So, let's see. Oops. Our point of departure is dust, how it is everywhere, and how for the most part it is invisible. I'll start with a quote from Stephen Connor's essay on pulverulence, and here I quote, "Much of the magical power of dust seems to come from the fact that it is reversible. Dust is simultaneously dispersive. It is a broadcasting, something to conjure with. Dust is the stuff of illusion." End of quote. In that sense, the appearance and disappearance of dust gives it a paradoxical immateriality that also is a mark of materiality. UC Perica, in his essay, Dust and Exhaustion, the Labor of Media Materialism, calls dust a non-thing. poetic, perhaps even magical, because it can be anywhere and nowhere to be seen. So much for conjuring here. Okay, there you go. Perhaps even magical because it can be anywhere and nowhere to be seen. I would like to invite you to think of materiality as a set of relations of what we cannot see. Dust, pollution, contamination, but also things like labor, exhaustion, depression, and energy, and even further, the cables that bring us connectivity, signals and information, invisible things. I invite you to think of the ways in which technology is produced and is invisible to us who interact with devices on a daily basis. To help us, we'll look at dust to different artistic manifestations. In this example here, we see dust rendered visible in this prepared accumulation, a rendition of Quotidian Traces by artist Paul Hazelton. So I'll give you a very brief contextualization of this presentation. To situate our discussion, the context is global capitalism, transnational commerce, neoliberal economies, free market, deregulated industry, cheap labor, outsourcing, hazardous work conditions, high energy production and consumption, and environmental effects, in an exploration of what Parikh calls media natures, or as I quote, a double bind of media and nature as co-constituting spheres where the ties are intensely connected in material, non-human realities, as much as in relations of power, economy, and work, end of quote. To contextualize the theoretical framework, I'll be reading Dust along Parikh's proposition of a media archaeology, which to my understanding is a method that takes into consideration medium specificity, non-linear historicity, and as in old media inform contemporary new media, and examines the conditions of existence of media in a Foucauldian sense, but most importantly from a Friedrich Kittler's sense, who claims that understanding technical media is a matter of materiality. To locate this kind of criticism within the tendency of new materialism, I'll say that studying history through its material conditions is not new. But in the advent of our digital cultures, there are critics who are preoccupied with the ways in which not only technical media processes and transmits culture, but also how technical media processes materials, objects, things, and non-solid things. More specifically, the focus is on processes of materialization as they relate to politics and aesthetic and ethics. The relationality of humans and non-humans affects variations, intensities of bodies, such as movement and contact, non-object-based materialities, and the interfaces of bodies and media tech. Also, it is important to note that new awareness of multiple materialities and new mediations in our lives lead to new subjectivities, new perceptions and interactions with the world and our communities, and also entail political and environmental effects, raising new ethical issues. And here I'm referring mostly to the work of Catherine Hales. The study of media is the study of material history in some ways. And in the words of Parikh, again, I quote, material ephemerality of technical media cultures and the messy networks in which one materiality is transformed into another one, end of quote. To return to Dust, I'll first show you the work of artist Marcel Duchamp, who most of you probably know or definitely know. Duchamp problematized art with a cheeky proposition that he called ready-made, where he appropriated manufactured found objects as art, questioning authorship, production, and even the very notion of art itself by inserting the importance of concept and humor. The Duchamp's piece that matters to us today is The Bride Stripped Bare by Herr Bachelor's Even, also known as The Large Glass, which is a mixed media object that combines two panes of glass, lead foil, fuse wire, and dust. Duchamp was interested in works that demonstrated maximum effect for minimal effort. And conceptually, this work has eluded critics for a long time. This piece plays on puns, on mechanical industrialization, and chance. But adding dust as one of the main components, as already made, reflects on passive material conditions. Nevertheless, the accumulated dust reflects on the passage of time or of a purposeful inactivity, and as Perica points out, dust is active here. Marilena Parlati argued that Duchamp's large glass, by making dust accessibly visible, marks, I quote, the uncanny interplay between visibility and tangibility, as between permanence and volatility, art and nature, end of quote. Here is a famous photograph of Man Ray that demonstrates the active role the random accumulation of dust played in making Duchamp's piece. The process of dust breeding, as the work lies about Duchamp's house for a few years, is documented, rendering the invisible visible in the presence of a paradox, an inherent inactive labor that surrounds us as a number of environmental factors generate an incessant production of dust. As Parlati points out, Man Ray's photograph is a dustscape that reveals, I quote, the contented borders between agency and non-agency, end of quote, and how dust is the most demanding of found objects given its time requirements. Dust works as medium and vehicle of time and inactive action. Not only is dust active and indicates the passage of time, dust has maximum exposure, is everywhere and exposes surfaces. According to Connor, I quote, dust is characterized by maximum of what might be called internal exposure, in which the ratio of the surface area of particles to their internal mass is extremely high. And because they have no inside, because they're all a kind of internal exposure, dust-like substances can give contours or clarifying outlines to other things. Thus, itself formless, edgeless, dust can both dissolve form and disclose it. End of quote. And the example I have here for this point is a work by Claudio Parmigiani, Polvere, from 1999. Parmigiani worked on installations from 97 to 99 of rooms that previously had been filled with objects and exposed to smoke and dust. Once removed, the objects left their silhouettes or negative space marks, showing what Connor calls the disclosive power of dust. Speaking of exposure, I would like to discuss dust and the possibilities of invisible contamination. Connor observes that dust can get everywhere, I quote, insinuating itself into every crevice. It is both a terminal and a mediate matter, inert, but sometimes, for that very reason, omnivalent, end of quote. In that sense, the proposition is to move from the relational aspects of dust and objects to dust and the body, meaning human bodies, but also other organisms and the Earth's planetary body. Specifically, we move to Parica's serious concerns, the lungs and environment hazards. As Joseph Amato discusses in his historical treatise on dust, every industry creates a peculiar dust and smoke, defining historical periods. In many ways, this demonstrates how in a media historical contextualization proposed by Parica, I quote, the biological and the technological are co-determining forces, end of quote. In the mechanics of labor, there is a relationship between the abundance of dust in our bodies, how we may be contaminated by infinitesimal particles and by work, such as with coal miners, for example. Parica in Dust and Exhaustion discusses how humans and non-humans are affected, the level of the relationship between organisms and the environment, especially regarding labor in the tech industry, the dehumanization in such industries, how some humans and non-humans have become disposable in the present conjuncture of conglomerate capitalism, and how media tech is inscribed in the bodies of workers. Through examples from gaming and art, we'll examine how material relations sustain the tech industry, the interconnectedness of environment and labor, specifically in mining and factories, and the secret tragedies and violations that have surrounded the industry. I'm specifically talking about exploitation and human rights violation in coltan mining in the Congo, the Foxconn factory's suicides committed in 2010, and Silicon Valley contamination, to mention just a few cases. Our next example from 2008 by Harwood Wright and Yoko Koji is called Tantalum Memorial, and we see a telephone installation. So I'll be reading the description of the pieces that I'll be describing here first, because it is very important to understand the context and the concept behind these pieces. So I'll be reading about three descriptions for each piece, and then I'll be happy to analyze it later with you. According to the description, the installation works, and I quote, as a memorial to the more than 3 million people who have perished in the complex wars that have gone on in the Congo since 1998, often referred to as the Coltan Wars. In another source, I found another figure, which was 5.4 million deaths. The ore coltan is used as the raw material for the metal tantalum, which is an essential component of mobile phones and computers. Therefore, tantalum is coveted by dozens of international mining industries and local warring groups, and is nowadays more valuable than gold. Built of electromagnetic telephone switches, invented in 1938, and connected to a computer, the installation serves not only as a memorial, but functions also as a center of a social telephone network that is used by Congolese immigrants living in the UK. The network Telephone Trottoir builds on the traditional Congolese communication practice of passing around news and gossip from pedestrian to pedestrian on the street to avoid state censorship. In cooperation with a London-based radio program, it calls Congolese listeners and plays messages which can be commented and forwarded. The project classifies as a means of communication between tradition and modernity. This art piece exposes the geopolitics of hardware, the painful implications of tech labor, physically and emotionally, to the Congolese, and the ensuing displacements with refugee immigration to London. In some senses, this installation is an artistic exploration of a media archaeology that combines old tech with awareness of material conditions for new tech. Our next example is a game called Phone Story from 2011, developed by YES Lab activist Michael Pinacci and designed by Paolo Pedercini for Molle Industrie. In this app game, the player has to force children in the developing world to mine coltan and has to prevent suicides at a Foxconn factory. The game was banned by Apple from their app store after 4 days. 4 days, right? Claiming it violated their app policies by, for example, showing child labor in an ironic twist of denial of Apple's own implication in unethical labor practices. So the main reason was, oh, it shows child labor, we cannot have this app there. Next is the game iMine from 2012, developed by Gottlieb González-Diegues and Kokomova. I'll read the descriptions then. In the game, you play a miner digging one of the precious ingredients for today's electronics, tin, tungsten, or tantalum, basically conflict minerals. It is not possible to win at iMine. You can only survive. It's not funny, though, but you can only survive as long as you can. This is the dark reality of the hundreds of thousands of miners mining in difficult, dangerous, or even lethal conditions for the minerals of high-tech electronics around the globe right now. Okay, so these two games are satirical, of course, in the case of Phone Story, and nihilistic in the case of iMine, both having the intention to raise public awareness about the material conditions of labor to make tech devices. But what I find most interesting is that the device itself is used to disseminate the sort of denunciation through media. I'm very curious to know what you think. Is this self-reflexiveness, tactical media infiltration, or hypocrisy? Or is it a complex, vicious circle whereby to criticize networks of production, it is necessary to use the very media that is being produced, which is, of course, what I'm doing here. So, the next example will look at an example that comments on energy production and consumption even more directly. This work is called Coal-Fired Computers, a 2010 installation by Yoha Hardwood and Yoko Koji, in which I'll read the description. A coal-fired boiler powers a network of computers exploring the relationship between power, art, and media. Black lungs inflate every time a database record of miners' lung disease is shown on the computer monitors. The piece explores the ecologies that have created and maintained power and the health residues and crises of fueling that power. From the concept, this installation calls awareness to the consequences of the energy necessary to make and use computers. Each computer takes 250 kilos of fossil fuels to produce, and 300 million new computers are made each year. According to the World Health Organization, 300,000 people die in the world every year from exposure to coal dust, and 200,000 more from other lung-related diseases caused by contamination. At this point, we may say that ultimately, media relies on materials, and to quote Parika, I quote, the digital is a regime of energies. To return to the notion of dust as vehicle, as carrier, and in the sense of contamination, the body may be considered as media. With the contaminant agents in our blood and air streams, and as such, dust is a material agent of transformation. And in less tragic senses as well, as Parik reminds us, since there's dumb dust and smart dust, as the rapid development of nanotechnology shows us, but of course not without consequences. In relation to most recent developments of In relation to most recent developments of microtechnology, let's consider semiconductors. The material and cultural history of dust entails the history of hygiene and how hygiene has been a progress indicator in urban societies. From at least the Industrial Revolution, dust has been declared an enemy by public health officials. Amato observes that industrialized societies have won a great victory over dust. Nevertheless, our own era is engaged in new battles. The obverse of dust would be extreme hygiene, and there is a direct correlation between the fabrication of semiconductors and dust, or the extreme lack thereof. We'll look at one example that reflects on extreme hygiene and extreme contamination. We'll watch a clip from the series How We Got to Now. The series, it's from PBS and BBC. The series documents the history of revolutionary inventions, such as the sewers, toilet, the use of chlorine to disinfect water, the incandescent light bulb, etc. So, if everything works well, we'll be able to watch it. Is the sound?
Jonathan? raise transistors on a microchip can measure less than a tenth of a single micron. A speck of household dust landing on one of these delicate silicon wafers would be comparable to Mount Everest landing in the streets of Manhattan. And that is why clean is so vitally important here.
So this is really what this is all about, right? This is a wafer. It didn't even need a cleaner space here, right?
That is correct. And this is what we're trying to achieve. This is a wafer, and there are thousands of individual microchips on that wafer. You can sort of see them individually, but it's difficult.
So in a way, the whole digital revolution that we celebrate, this bringing the world together, can only happen because we're able to think about friendliness on the level of microns, not on the level of, you know, the planet.
That's correct. And it's taken us a long time to figure out everything we need to do to make sure we're as clean as we can be.
Being able to master clean at the smallest scale has transformed our world. But the roots of all this stem from a simple desire almost 200 years ago to keep our city streets free of dirt.
Standing here in the clean room, I can't help but think of the sewers. In a way, it's really the two poles of human inventiveness, right? To be able to build the modern world, we had to create this incredibly disgusting space that we isolated from everyday life. And at the same time, to make the digital revolution, we had to create this hyper-clean place and also isolate everyone from it. And we never get to visit these environments. We never really see them. We never think about them. But without this kind of environment, without the incredible dirt and disgust from the sewer, modern life wouldn't be possible.
Interestingly enough, during Johnson's visit to the fabricators, we don't hear comments about the environmental impact of semiconductor manufacturing and how these dust-free spaces or clean rooms are filled with toxicity that may be harmful to employees and the environment, let alone the incredible massive amount of energy those factories require with their bright lights to prevent mildew. Semiconductors may be vital for the microchip industry, and certainly there's no visible pollution in those factories. Nevertheless, the chemicals used in these processes, sometimes over 300 per factory, are known as carcinogenic and pose serious health risks. In an article called The Environmental Impact of the Manufacturing of Semiconductors, Jason Holden and Christopher Kelty discussed the multiple casualties of the industry in Silicon Valley involving multiple deaths, many cases of employee cancer and miscarriages, as well as class action lawsuits, and the failure of these companies even to ensure proper ventilation systems, for example, let alone prevent the amount of dangerous chemicals released in the environment. From the extreme dust-free environment of manufacturing, we'll go to the afterlife of products, and we'll see examples of planned obsolescence and e-waste. Parika is particularly interested in what they call zombie media and dead media devices, and how sometimes they have an afterlife through art or recycling, but not necessarily free of contamination. Basically, if there is an exhaustion in the tech world labor, there is also, I quote, uneven networks of distribution, space distribution, and labor distribution, to quote Parika, who points out that there are more cell phones in Africa than clean water. This discrepancy is one of the factors contributing to the enormous amount of e-waste produced. In that sense, the dust of afterlife of products as a result of networks of consumption demonstrates how, I quote, dust is a rhetorical device mobilizing entangled materialities of global labor and residue materialism, end of quote. To discuss EU waste, I will start with a clip from the movie Manufactured Landscapes of 2006, directed by Jennifer Bakewell. The film shows the journey of Canadian photographer Eduardo Brustinski through the world, photographing industrial landscapes in contrast to natural ones. We're just going to watch a little clip of it.
Another aspect of what's happening in China is that a lot of the recycled materials that are collected here are being taken to China by ship. That's a cube metal. This is armatures, electrical armatures, where they have copper and the high-end steel from electrical there. And the way they recycle is that they actually heat up the boards, and with pairs of pliers to pull off all components. They're trying to get all of the valued metals out of those components. But the toxic smells, when you're coming to a town that's actually doing this kind of burning of the boards, you can smell it a good 5 or 10 kilometers before you get there.
I guess I lost him. It's okay. I guess we had enough. This documentary shows the effects of materials and industrial practices around the world and transformed landscapes, as well as technology ruins. There is a question here of aesthetics and politics, however, of the possible aestheticization of people's precarious living conditions and contamination, or the potential pitfall of presenting other countries and cultures as solely responsible for deregulated industrial practices. So there's a lot that's wrong with this documentary and Burstynsky's work. Nevertheless, this movie and Burstynsky's photographs speak to the complicity of consumers as well. Focusing now on planned obsolescence, the concept was initially planned by Bernard London in 1932 as a proposed solution to the Great Depression to increase consumption. So a quote here, in London's mind, consumers that continue to use and reuse devices long after they were purchased prolonged the economic downturn. His proposal outlined that every product should be labeled with an expiration date, end of quote. London's proposition never quite took off until later with current tech production. And this practice became embedded in a commodity fetishism, to use Marx's term, where the production value of a product is different than the perceived or assigned value. And it is important to its mystique to maintain the means of production hidden. There are other factors at play, such as fashion and symbolic capital of buying certain new products, as well as technological advances that renew capabilities and render hardware obsolescent. All factors generating a conspicuous consumerism. In relation to excessive consumption, critic Christo Bartolovich has discussed how consumption may be imposed as a civilizatory process or a progress indicator. Consumption derives from necessity, but also from desire, and there's a constant network producing desire to buy, leading to accumulation, even though currently we're going through an environmental crisis that perhaps will lead to desire training or a re-education of desire as called for by Herbert Marcuse. To illustrate the life of a gadget, here is a Bruce Sterling, I'm sorry about the quality, graph showing the public's perception of technological development and how the emotional investment is related to the life of an object. That is to say that technological developments are only really visible if they translate into products to buy. Right? So there's a product peaks and then sort of dissipates as it comes out of use. Obsolescence requires a temporal dimension, a chain of hardware replacements, which render software obsolete or dusty. Perica refers to Jennifer Grabby's book, Digital Rubbish, A Natural History of Electronics, where dust operates once again as a marker of temporality, specifically in relation to waste and obsolescence. I'll quote here, dust is a more accurate marker of media technologies than the accelerating speed of information. Covered in dust, obsolescent technologies remind of this other time, the remainder of technological use and progress. Dust might just be an underlying condition. Can we start to unravel the conditions of existence of media from dust? End of quote. Moving on to metal, Perica has recently proposed a new discussion of a pan-metalism, and the ubiquitous presence and importance of metals to our cycles of production, evoking alchemy. But before we talk about alchemy, let's be reminded again of products of desire. Apple products, for example. Parika comments on the variations of the Apple Watch in gold or titanium, and the contemporary public revaluing of precious metals. This may fall under a corporate digital aesthetics of shine. I guess it's the new thing, shining. Although the effects are sometimes disastrous, such as aluminum dust that contaminates factory workers and the environment. Aluminum is the most widely distributed metal in the world, and miners and factory workers, as well as ours, are exposed. We can see how the history of technology and technoculture is related to networks anchored in a transformation of materials, but also in a transformation of culture, from mining and manufacturing to waste and contamination, from needs and desires to fashion and market-driven ideology to power relations. That is to say that history is material and cultural history that involves physical and ideological conditions. To paraphrase Parika one last time, technology operates as an active agent in the ontological and epistemological sense. This notion reverberates with the proposition of dust as media, or even maybe as an episteme, and definitely as an agent of transformation. To discuss the point of transformation, this is the last video we'll be watching. We watch a short art movie by Toby Smith called Rare Earthenware of 2015 on the art made by Unknown Fields Division in collaboration with Kevin Cullingham. Oh. hope you could see the text. These are the vases that were produced in this piece. From their description, the artists traced the global supply chain of rare earth elements, the 17 most sought-after minerals in the world used in high-end electronics and green technologies, to their source at a toxic lake in Inner Mongolia, showing well-concealed journeys taking place across global supply chains. The resulting three ceramic vessels were made from the radioactive lake mud. Each is sized in relation to the amount of waste created in the production of three items of technology: a smartphone, a featherweight laptop, and the cell of a smart car battery. Here we see how even green or eco products are complicitous with an environmentally harmful production. So to conclude, the examples we saw render the invisible visible and show those well-concealed journeys of production, distribution, and consumption. Now, I would like to examine for a minute this invisibility of networks of production in relation to notions of technology and magic. In the history of media, photography and subsequently cinema were once considered magical, and they also entail a series of chemical and production processes. As we know, silver is necessary to make films, and a series of other materials and labor are necessary to make cameras, analog or digital. Walter Benjamin once influentially pointed out to the notion that the camera, like the surgeon, penetrates, revealing the mechanisms of production, but nevertheless remaining distant, observing what is usually invisible to the eye, the modes of production. On the contrary, painting and magic maintain their aura and mystery, but produce a spiritual proximity to the public. How many of us use our screens, large or small, without thinking of all the labor and exhaustion involved in the process? In so many ways, the camera is invisible as a medium, and we forget how far the device had to travel to shoot our selfies. And yet, in our increasing possibilities of augmented reality, there are more complex and politicized hidden images to be decoded. That is what drives the variety of artworks that we looked at today. The last example that I have is a 2015 installation called Mineral Vision by Abelardo G. Fournier, made of a copper dust screen mounted on wood. The public can only see the copper dust until the piece is activated by a mobile device, a smartphone or a tablet, revealing a phrase by Roman historian Tacitus that says, "Where they create a desert, they call it peace." Perhaps alluding to an environmental devastation, I don't know if I'm being too negative, but deserts are made of dust. But so is everywhere covered in dust. And by rendering invisible networks visible, by revealing the permeating dust that accompanies us as we go from stardust to dust, we hopefully examine our role in social responsibility. That's all I have. Thank you. So, thank you so much for listening, and I'll be happy to take you questions, right, and engage in a discussion, a productive conversation on the materials and theory if you want. But I have an announcement, so I'll do it now before you start taking off. So I'm also an artist, and on Thursday we're having an event at Vivo Media Arts, and it's a monthly event produced or projected, I guess, by Jay Salum, and it's the last Thursday of every month. It's called Thirst Days, and this Thursday at 7:30 will be a group show that I'm part of, curated by Denise Reiner and Tonel, and I'll be performing with an artificial intelligence courtesy of Steve DePaola from SFU. So I'll pass this around again. April 28th. Sorry, it's Thursday, April 28th at 7:30 at Vivo Media Arts. So thank you. So while you're thinking of dust, any questions or comments? Nice ones, kind ones, or interesting ones, curious ones.
The report on
ordinary dust carries some nutrients or some oxygenation or something like that. Volcanic dust. Yeah. No, that's a test to the transformational aspect that I was talking about, the chemical aspect, right? In which, if we consider my proposition that dust works as media, then it permeates everything and thus engages in these processes, chemical processes that are unseen or invisible to the eye, and yet it reflects the networks of what Perica calls media natures. Right? This is a great example. Anybody else? Comments or questions? Yes, Kyle, please.
You mentioned that this is you're starting off a kind of new project. Where do you think this is going to go? Are you going to use the same kind of materials in your analysis in the future, or where do you think it's going to go?
All right, so this was an exploratory talk based on UC Perica's texts and examples, right? So he discusses. More precisely, he has a book called What's Media Archaeology, and I'll get to my work in a second, but What's Media Archaeology, and then his latest book is A Geology of Media, in which he has a chapter on dust, and this is where this dust and exhaustion essay comes from. So the examples come directly, almost all of them, not all of them, but directly from Perica's work. And in my own work, so this is an exploratory paper in the sense that I am starting to understand how contemporary media theory articulates this relationship between the conceptual and the material and the physical, right? So in my own research, one of my fields of specialization is embodiment and the body, and I have particularly studied concrete poetry from Brazil, but from other places, and this relationship of poetry with technology and creative and critical methods to articulate these mediations, technological mediations in art. Right, so that's, I would say, that's what I work with. So within that context and the context of embodiment and technology, and in my own artwork, that's one of the things that I address. So in the context of embodiment and media, and how new media theories, contemporary media theories, articulate this relationship of the material with the technology, the material networks of the technology, I would like to take that and apply to other artistic manifestations or mediations. Of course, I'm a Latin Americanist, so most likely I'll be choosing works from Latin America, but lately I've been working with the Americas as an hemisphere, so my intention is to convey some sense new cultural formations that revolve around dust and new technology. I don't know if I answered your question, but it's too convoluted. But anyway, but I'm interested in entropy as well, right? So eventually I'll get to that. And more specifically, which might be often a tangent, I'm very much interested also in some Afro-American religious practices that intersect with technology. So that's how this the idea of invisibility would come in. So what's invisible, the spiritual world, the technological world. Not to go too much into that, but yes.
Well, first of all, thank you, Alessandra. It was really a very, very thoughtful and moving presentation.
Thank you.
There was this documentary about the
Excuse me.
So I was looking at how the, it was a documentary about how polluted were the oceans and how the fish is caught and that kind of thing. So in a way, I was eating this fish curry and at the same time watching this documentary that really made me feel very, very anguished about that. And when I see your presentation and all these artistic pieces, I wonder how we can reflect in regards of that thing that is coming from the real in a kind of way, right?
Right.
But that is materialized very important. And in lives, in health, and all that kind of impact, how can we be conscious about that without getting in the retail therapy, right? Because, I mean, as soon as your phone is about to expire in the phone whatever program, you are being pushed to get another one. As soon as your hybrid car is about to finish your kind of lease, there's a push for that. So my reflection is how one can be able to sustain that anguish that comes from the getting conscious about what is happening without getting into the retail therapy.
Well, I'm not sure if I can answer your question directly, but I'll try. So there is the idea is that one of the questions, operating questions that I posed in the beginning was, how can we have a sustainable tech industry? And what environmental solutions may we envision given the conditions of tech production? And certainly, I don't have effective solutions for this right now, but I do believe that there are ways of having an ethical tech industry. And I'm not sure how that would operate given all these networks of production that we saw tonight. Now, to answer your question more directly, I would say that one of the themes of these essays that I was discussing here today by UC Parika have to do with this notion of exhaustion and depression, right? So exhaustion, physical exhaustion, but also exhaustion of these old ways of seeing things, of old approaches, of just accepting things as they are and having all these machines and all this, or even food, to use your example, around us without really reflecting on the chains, right, the immense chains, not so much in a linear way, as that is to say that historically we arrive where we are. And I think that the theories that I'm presenting today by Parika precisely challenge that and say that that these progress indicators that we have that have to do with consumption of technology, and sometimes we are forced to buy new products, as I mentioned, with the hardware obsolescence, right? So I think that I don't know if I can answer the question about anxiety and depression more precisely. That is to say that we're not merely consumers. There's no way, I don't believe that. And therefore, the critical aspect comes in. And I think that even people who are not studying these theories could become more aware of this networks of production. But I don't know if you can avoid the anxiety that this generates. And in some senses, I think we are all aware that if we start thinking about everything that led to the moment where we are right now, we would go crazy, right?
Right.
So anyway... Anybody else? any other? It's overwhelming, basically. But it's just a matter of, I guess what I'm talking about is awareness and consciousness and reflection especially. But then, in moving from that to more ethical production, right? But I don't know exactly what is the, there are viable ways of doing it, whether it's by voting.
Yeah, thank you. It kind of brings a dial. My point was that anxiety perhaps is
Oh, that without anxiety, you wouldn't...
The trigger in a way to be aware of consciousness, but being aware of every single piece could be...
Well, apathy and complacency are certainly very dangerous, right? And I'm a professor, so one of my jobs is to question everything with the students, right? So that's what I'm doing at the university. If not, then I'm not doing my job. So any other questions or comments? Reflections? Thanks.
Anything else?
Yes.
Yeah. Super interesting, and it's sort of brought up a lot of different issues. One of the things that stood out for me was this whole thing about cleanliness. And
yes.
That was kind of relating slightly to what
Hilda, yeah. Yes. So I think that your question leads me to this notion of the theory that's behind this, right, of this idea of media archaeology, or, I mean, combines Foucault with Kittler in a way, that is to say that you were examining the conditions of existence, right? So how did this come to be, I mean, in a sense of the genealogy of this, but most directly to see how, what are the power relations that led us to arrive at this moment, right? And this moment being nonlinear, I mean, considering everything that is in the past and everything that is in the future. So in some senses, I think Parikh and others, or Jeff Winthrop, Young, consider Kittler's theories as an archaeology of the present, right? And I'm referring specifically now to a media archaeology that does discuss, power, the relationship between power and discourse formation, but also not just discourse formation, but objects. So objects as objects of knowledge, so everyday objects in this sense, right? So we're talking about soap. I mean, you know, so how do these objects, these quotidian objects, relate to this relationship that takes us back to this, not to say origin, but to the path, leading to the past and leading to the future, right, of everything. Certainly, that video that I showed about the clean room is a very specific case, but you're right that in our houses, we are also very preoccupied with hygiene, simply because, we want a clean house, but not only that, but where does that come from, right? With this, comes from this the fact that hygiene is a progress indicator, that hygiene is a civilizatory, part of the civilizatory process, right? And here we are. So and then we generate all sorts of specific cases, such as pathology or cleaning, or obsessively cleaning, and so on and so forth. But not just that, just regular hygiene. But that is to say that, that would be an archaeology of everyday life, if you will. Right?
Excuse me. You say hygiene and civilization.
Yes. Yes.
It's men who declared this thing, which is part of life, fertilizer, excrement, these are dirty. It was men that declared that.
Yes.
And right now we have the problem with the cities that are, we have heat islands because we have all our water being thrown away because some people, which I will accuse women, have this fear of dirt. And because we have this fear of dirt, all these areas are dry, ugly. People are getting sick because they don't have enough exposure to dirt. And now all the water is being wasted, being thrown away. Now we're told to water our trees with chlorinated water. And we have to pay for it. Every time it rains, it costs every idiot who lives in a controlled, confined, incarcerated area called a city money.
Well, it's men and women, right?
Pardon?
It's men and women.
So I guess I'll take your question seriously, and I'll answer it. So I'll say that when I said civilizatory process, I meant it critically, of course. I'm talking about, I mean, I come from post-colonial studies background, and I, as far as I understand, the civilizatory process has been incredibly damaging, and it's been responsible for the massacre of many people and species and cultures. So in that sense, that's what I meant. I meant as a criticism that it is part of this history of progress and civilizatory process. process that has imposed ways of life of those in power. Right. So that's one thing to clarify. And then I'm not sure I followed, but yes, people tend to, people in urban settings, but in other places too, tend to want a clean place and spend a lot of money with water and cleaning products, if that's what you meant. I'm not sure. But anyway, anybody else?
Last salvos before we finish? Okay, on that note, please join me in thanking Alessandra. And please come to her performance at Vivo on Thursday. Thanks for coming out, everybody.
Thank you all for coming.